Hi, welcome to Off Script. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today on the show, we're taking a look at The Long Walk, that Stephen King adaptation where a bunch of young men all keep walking and last one standing wins. The other ones all get murdered by the military. Yeah, it's out. And boy, real sunshine kind of movie. Really a feel good picture.
Walk or die.
Dude, it's okay. It's a good time. It's a little dour, but it's a good time. Stick around for the review. We're also going to take a look at some TV. All right, we're going to catch up on Alien Earth. Andy and I have been watching this show. Very cinematic. Noah Hawley is doing something really special over here. We want to catch you up on where the show's at. The finale's in a few weeks, I think. So it's not too late to kind of catch up and jump in, but we want to take a look at it. I want to talk really briefly about the Emmys because those happened this weekend. It's not exactly a television show, but as I platform the TV show we're about to talk about, figure it might be worth touching on just briefly, a couple funny highlights. We're going to take a look at some upcoming trailers, namely for the new Knives Out movie, Wake Up Dead Man, huh? Coming to Netflix. That's going to be a good time. Sydney Sweeney's got two upcoming pictures we're going to take a look at. Stick around so we can talk about her. Before we get to all of it, we need to catch up with the news. Our first story this week, dude, it is the world of The Conjuring, and we're all just living in it. After an incredible run of the new Conjuring movie at the box office, they're doing another thing, and they're making a TV show, and now they've got an HBO Max series set. It's all very exciting. Andy, what do Conjuring fans need to know about this? Because I'm not a Conjuring fan, and I skipped the last movie, and it seems like maybe everybody's talking about it.
I've seen like two of these movies. We famously reviewed the third one, The Devil Made Me Do It, a couple years ago. It's got a devoted fan base, and we'll be talking about its box office success a little bit later. But on the heels of that, a HBO Max TV show was announced, which I think has been development for a couple of years now, but has finally got the green light. That I'm sure that has everything to do with the success. It looked like this series, this franchise, was maybe winding down a bit, but like this weekend's box office was just been insane, and so they greenlit this show. And it's interesting where you can go because it's basically a bunch of made up ghost stories. I think you can do some interesting recasting, maybe young versions of these, the Conjuring origins or something to that extent, because Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga are part of the reason this series works, this franchise works. They've become staple of it. So you'd have to have some really good casting for these people. So it'll be interesting to see what angle they take.
Yeah, the talent behind the TV show is real strong. It's happening over at HBO, so if you have an HBO Max subscription, that's where you'll watch it. Nancy Wan is the showrunner. She has worked on Supernatural, the CW show, which I used to watch way back in the day. Jericho, she worked on Jessica Jones at Netflix, Little Fires Everywhere at Hulu. Additionally, the writers for the show, what are their names here? Peter Cameron and Cameron Squires. Cameron and Cameron, attorneys at law, writers on The Conjuring on HBO. They've worked on multiple Marvel projects. They worked on Werewolf by Night, Agatha All Along, Moon Knight, WandaVision. Big talent behind this thing. One of them's got The Boys, I'm sorry, Gen V over on HBO, or on Amazon. Star Wars series The Acolyte. Like, so a lot of talent behind this thing. Like, seems real promising. And like Andy said, like, super formulaic. Very easy to do. Supernatural did it for like 13 seasons or something, right? It's a ghost week. It's great. Or you do some sort of larger mystery, right? And then you're like ghostbusting week over week. I had heard something about maybe a prequel movie or show. Do you know if this is what that's supposed to be? I don't know if that's just a rumor. I couldn't even tell you.
That's a good direction to take this because the meat of the Warrens ghost hunting is happening in like the 60s and 70s. Back before we have things like better cameras everywhere, the internet, better research and skepticism and things. So it's when that sort of thing was, you could kind of get away with it a little bit more. And depending on who you asked, the Warrens were more or less hucksters and just kind of faked or helped people fake, different apparitions and ghost stories for monetary gain. So depending on who you ask, but Warner Brothers has painted this very interesting picture of them in the universe that they're actual ghost hunters and they're solving crimes. A little bit like the X-Files, I think, almost every week, but it's sure to be a hit.
Yeah, they might be some of, I mean, if they were hucksters, they might be some of the best to ever do it, considering the like $2.5 billion this cinematic universe has pulled in for Warner Brothers so far. Like, absolutely insane. I know the last one's supposed to be the wrap-up. It seems like that's absolutely not true, and they're just going to keep making more of these things. Why wouldn't they? They got a head on their hands. It's crazy. More Conjuring to come. Keep it on Off Script for more. Super Mario Brothers. We got a new movie announcement. We knew a new movie was coming, a follow-up to the $1 billion earner that was Nintendo Illumination's Super Mario Brothers movie. Well, now the second one is here. It has a name. Andy, tell the good folks at home what they're calling this feature.
The follow-up will be the Super Mario Brothers. No, the Super Mario Galaxy movies.
You got it.
I kept wanting to introduce the Super Mario Galaxy movies. I kept wanting to insert Brothers. It's funny. This is such like a search engine title because there are so many Nintendo games already. They don't want you to accidentally go to the game when they mean the movie. So that's why they put that in there. That's absolutely an SEO move. This was a super, you know, pardon the pun. A very successful children's film. We reviewed it. It's great children's stuff. Not a whole lot there for adults, but over $1 billion. And we've talked about this, how we are kind of out of the era of the superhero film and into the era of the video game movie. That's what's huge now. That's what Gen Z is all about, is online culture and video games. And so that's what the studios are kind of focusing on now. And this was a massive, massive hit. Looks like this is going to be out in 2026. So just a few months away, about 8 months.
It's crazy. It's coming out ahead of their Zelda movie, because that was kind of supposed to be the next thing that had been talked about. Like, oh, they're going to do a Zelda movie next, live action Zelda movie, coming from Maze Runner director Wes Ball. And then we talked about the casting announcement over there. A couple of relatively unknown young actors, a young actor and actress playing Zelda and Link, but. That's coming out in 2027. So the new Super Mario Bros. Movies, aptly titled Super Mario Galaxy, the Super Mario Galaxy movie. Yeah, Brothers is gone. Just Super Mario Galaxy movie. That's coming out a year ahead. That'll be out next year. So, going to be another banger. I played Super Mario Galaxy, for what it's worth, as far as like video game insight goes. Not much. I would have figured they would have done another journey in like the Mushroom Kingdom, or go to one of the various like lands you travel to in like Super Mario World, like, you know, Lava Land or Snow Land. Like, there's a bunch of those in Mario games. You jump into different worlds, but Galaxy obviously takes us into the universe, right? Mario's zipping around planets and jumping on big cosmic aliens, and he meets Rosalina, who's the cosmic princess of the space princess up there. It's all real fun, you know, a really good game, but I don't know how much of that translates to like the kid movie that they're obviously making. But, you know, hey, it'll have the galaxy theme. They can get the universe print on everything, you know, purple and Andy's right. It'll make good SEO. Super Mario Galaxy movie coming next year to a theater near you. We can talk about the box office. I did actually pull up the story. Boom. This Demon Slayer movie was making a bunch of money that I don't know anything about.
Yeah, absolutely. I forgot that we took a week off because The Conjuring was the big hit last weekend, so it's been supplanted. Still a ton of money. But yes, the number one at the box office was a new anime film, Demon Slayer. Kimetsu no Yaiba Infinity Castle, which is part of a trilogy of these Demon Slayer films. This movie is apparently like 3 hours long. It came out in Japan a couple of weeks ago already, so it's been on the market. Made $70 million domestically over the weekend and has made $450 million globally. Like I said, it's been out for a while overseas. So it's a massive, massive hit.
Oh my
and
God.
Again, $70 million. This is again like, and same thing with The Conjuring. The Conjuring came in second with a $26 million. But it's made $131 million domestic, $330 million globally. And it's the most successful in the Conjuring franchise, which is crazy. Because like I said, it looked like we were sunsetting this franchise, winding down. I think Vera Farmiga and the other guy, Patrick Wilson, are both kind of tired of it. Like, they're ready to move on to other things. So we thought that this would, you know, it would do fine. It would have its super fans. But it's just been a massive, massive hit.
Dude.
Number three at the box office. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, dude, the U.S. is absolutely in decline. Like, it's crazy that K-pop Demon Hunters and this movie, Demon Slayer, essentially take some of the best elements of a culture that is so foreign to us and absolutely slays August. And meanwhile, like, we can barely get folks overseas to go into superhero movies anymore. Like, Fantastic Four is underperforming domestically and, like, Superman's not doing that. It's like, oh, boy. Oh boy, people are not coming out for the foreign stuff, but the foreign stuff's a hit over here, and that rocks. Shout out to the animated features, man. I'm sorry. Yeah, both huge hits for August. Dude, $70 million opening weekend. That's crazy. That's crazy for an animated movie that like I wasn't even aware of. Oh my God.
So it kind of falls in line with, again, Gen Z being very online. Anime is a big, you know, deal amongst younger viewers as well. So this kind of falls into that category as well. Number three at the box office was Downton Abbey, the grand finale, with 18 million domestic, 30 million worldwide. In line with expectations, they have a, you know, the diehard fan base of those movies. I hear they're fine. Like, if you're into them, it's great. If you're not, you know, goes down with a nice tea and a biscuit, as they say. Mark Kermode says often. You know, put it on the afternoon. Number four, which we're going to be talking about soon here, The Long Walk, with 11.5 million, 14 million worldwide. Again, within small, but within expectations. And then a surprise at number five, Toy Story. The original Toy Story had its 30th anniversary re-release at 3.5 million. So Toy Story still grabbing some numbers as well.
Yeah, and Hamilton scooping up 2.2 million for like a 10-day total. Disney put Hamilton in theaters, and like that scooped up a couple million. I saw TikToks of people like getting thrown out for singing too loud. It's really funny. hey, shout out to the nostalgia screenings. You know, Downton Abbey, a quick comment. I've seen that trailer so many times now. I feel like if I was old and I liked Downton Abbey, that would be such a great time at the movies. Like, it looks so grand and opulent, right? They're in these big sets and palaces, and they got like this whole horse race thing, and the costuming's divine. And like, man, it just seems like such a treat. And I just have not watched any of that show, and I haven't watched either of the other movies. And it's just so far from me. But like, man, they sure look like a great time. So like, shout out to Downton Abbey clearing 18 million. That's awesome. Long Walk, I thought this movie was going to be hard to market like early on. So seeing it pull 11 million over the weekend, like, I guess ain't bad. It's a cheap movie. It's a cheap movie to make for sure. I don't think it was very expensive, but looking forward to talking about it. And yeah, man, that's my thoughts at the box office. What do you think? Not too bad.
I mean, like I said, really stellar opening with this. I think this is the second Demon Slayer movie in this trilogy. And The Conjuring. This is the eighth film from Warner Brothers to come in at number one, which was last week. Over 40 million. They're like setting a new record this year because they've had eight films open at number one, over 40 million, never been done before. They're just on a super, super hot streak. Downton Abbey, the thing about that, there's a lot of people who really like it, but it's one of those things, it's a nostalgia fest, and it's also like, oh, if I was alive back then, I would have been, you know, genteel whatever British royalty, and it's like, right, you actually would have been as no it's like no you we all would have just been servants, and
right, we all would have been in food lines in the city, like waiting
been in bread lines
waiting for our gruel. That's where we'd be. Yeah.
Exactly.
God.
So but the, right. it has its dedicated fan base in there. It's doing fine.
Yeah, well, you know, hey, shout out to the Downton Abbey heads. It looks like a great time. I know it's supposed to be like the last one or whatever. I don't know, I just have an odd sort of respect for that franchise from far away. I'm just like, you know what? Good for them. Like, somebody's got to be watching this stuff. I get it. Anyway. And same goes for Demon Slayer, obviously. We got to talk about The Long Walk. I'm beating around the bush. Let me jump into it. I'm going to take the summary, so please excuse me, funny delivery. The movie is The Long Walk. So, The Long Walk is the story of Raymond Garrity, a young man growing up in dystopic future America, not too far off from our own, where the military has fundamentally taken over everything and has created a contest where every year one boy from each of the 50 United States comes together to walk endlessly down a road, and they just keep walking for days at a time. If you drop below 3 miles an hour, you get a warning, three warnings, and your ticket is punched. What your ticket being punched effectively means is you are shot in the street like a dog on camera. It's brutal, dog, and The Long Walk is a brutal rundown of 50 men, led, of course, by Cooper Hoffman playing Raymond Garrity. We also have David Johnson as Peter McFries, who is tremendous in this feature and does not get enough attention in the marketing. We have a host of other young boys as well. I don't want to get into anybody specific because it's quite the list. I'm sure we'll talk about them in the review. Each one looks like their own unique person. They have their own outfit and silhouette. Some are tall, some are short, skinny, fat. Everybody's their own thing. And slowly over the course of the film, we have to watch these boys walk and continue to walk and slowly get taken out. And it's a challenge and it's morally confusing. I think King wrote it originally as a commentary on the Vietnam War and young men signing up for service and then going and just kind of being a part of this machine. It's a challenging sort of movie, but it's been getting pretty interesting reviews. And I'm glad we watched it. I'm looking forward to talking about it. The movie is a long walk. Andy, what'd you think?
So I enjoyed this overall. It definitely is a bit of a heavy watch. One of the things I saw a lot of people posting about it was like, man, this movie's kind of sad. It's got kind of some heavy things. What I enjoyed about it is that it will, if you see it, it will feel like The Hunger Games, but this is actually predates The Hunger Games quite a bit. But there's just some similarities in that you have this lottery that that people from different states in a post-war, some post kind of apocalyptic war, where people sign up, and if you win, you get a bunch of money, and like position improves your life. But it's kind of a death wish if you don't win. So we have that similarity to The Hunger Games, but we meet an interesting cast of characters, and I remember thinking, I was like, this really feels like a war movie, not only in how people are killed, but in we meet a lot, just this wide cast of characters, people from all different backgrounds, and it's kind of about brotherhood. It's about life itself. It's about, again, the Vietnam War. There is a lot of dialogue, a lot of talking. This could almost work as a play in some respects, which I think would be an interesting treatment. But yeah, overall, I liked it.
Yeah, I like the shape of The Long Walk. But boy, I had a miserable time with it. I was one of those people that just got more progressively sad over the course of the movie. Because it's rated R, and the movie does not shy away from that. In fact, it gives you a soft start. The first couple times, they talk about the rules of the walk as Raymond and his mom, played by Judy Greer, are like driving up to the event. They keep saying, you get your ticket punched. Don't get your ticket punched. Hey, that guy's going to get his ticket punched. For like the first like 10 minutes of the movie, it's soft. They even show it in text. They don't say murder. You've seen the trailer. You know what you're getting into. But then when it actually comes down to it, most of it's on screen, and it's pretty brutal, man. Like it's pretty brutal. And so rated R, and that includes violence and gore, and it's for sure in there. I know that it's like a meditation on something larger, we'll get into that, but for what it is, I do like the shape of this movie. It's funny you mentioned Hunger Games. It's directed by Francis Lawrence, who directed most of the Hunger Games features. And it's a script by King and J.T. Molnar, who we most recently saw writing, directing Strange Darling, which was an indie darling that we covered earlier on the show this year. I like the shape of it. It's a road movie, right? Like, it's a bunch of characters on the road. And, like, as slowly as we go, they are eliminated one by one. It's one part, like, game show, especially with, like, the camera that's following them. This, like, truck just got one, like, lens out watching them. You know, you have a series of eliminations. You're right, Hunger Games is perfect. You can talk about it. Also a bit of, like, The Purge, especially with its like themes of like Americana. And yeah, some thoughts on the military industrial complex and how young men are kind of like, you know, they sign up voluntarily, but really a lot of them are doing it because they feel like that's what they're supposed to do. Like it's complicated. Some stuff on masculinity in there. I really like our cast. For how many boys are out walking, we really get to know probably about four of them really well. Four of them kind of become what they call the Four Musketeers and hang out a little bit a la Stephen King's Stand By Me, right? But really about 8 to 12 of them kind of get some more characterization on screen. And then many of them are just kind of in the background. You know, you'll see some boys walking back there. But for the most part, like, they're all very much their own people. Everybody has their own shape and silhouette. They're all very memorable. Like, you've got a couple of other bit players in there that we've seen in other films. The new Karate Kid is in there. A couple other indie darlings that I've seen. And everybody's very nice. The kid who plays Jojo Rabbit is in here. Everybody's, like, very nice and cool and sweet. And they get to be, like, friends. And it just makes it so much worse when they get eliminated, dog. Like, it really is a challenge for me. Like, I was struggling watching this movie.
Yeah, I wanted to jump in on these performances. So this is led by Cooper Hoffman, who's coming into it, his own, of course, the son of the late Philip Seymour Hoffman. David Johnson, who's really becoming a name for himself as well. We last saw him in Alien Romulus as the synthetic in that. And again, also starring Charlie Plummer, Ben Wong from the Karate Kid Legends, Roman Griffith Davis, who, as Zach said, is from Jojo Rabbit. Also, some adult performances. Judy Greer plays Ray Garrity's mother. And the one Mark Hamill, Luke Skywalker himself, plays the Major, which is kind of this gruff voice who yells instructions, that he eliminates people, kind of leading this whole thing. His is the only performance that doesn't work. The rest of them are like, you know, fresh-faced soldiers, essentially. Mark Hamill is like a caricature. It's like he's trying to do Robert Duvall from Apocalypse Now, but it's like a caricature. It really doesn't work. I think that's the only gripe I have. Everyone else is really stellar, though.
Yeah, Hamill's doing a really big character, and it's a choice, and it kind of doesn't work. The Major doesn't speak a lot in this movie. Like, while he is mostly riding along with them, you don't see him in every scene. Like, he gets little speech moments at the beginning, obviously towards the end, like, because he's kind of our main villain here. And he is, yeah, doing this really big, boisterous thing, and he's doing his big, like, voice actor, like, he's got the lungs out, man, in the performance. Like, I don't know, just kind of didn't work. Judy Greer is like this screaming mom who actually kind of works good, honestly. Like, it's a lot. It's really heavy what she's doing. She's Raymond's mom. But it's sincere and like solid. And I almost didn't recognize her in the open of the movie. I was like, oh my God, that's Judy Greer, dude. Like, normally I just see her doing soft comedy stuff. You know, I'd see her on like the new Netflix feature. But yeah, so I like everybody in here. I know they shot it in Canada. They said they shot it over like 15 days or like, I don't know, a month or something. And they said, yeah, they were walking something like 10 to 15 miles a day. And one of the crazy things about it is almost all of the movie is dolly shots and pulls and pans and motion because you were walking the entire time. It reminds me a little of something like Fury Road in the same way. Yeah, like you're driving almost that whole movie. Like you are consistently moving along. So the shape of this thing, having this long journey from beginning to middle to end, and seeing these characters you get to know, like, slowly get pulled out for one reason or another is tough, man. I like the warning system. It's a little convoluted. You don't really have to pay attention too much. But throughout the movie, you hear this, like, booming announcer voice from one of these trucks with these armed guards on it that's like, number 47, warning number 2, right? Number 38, warning 3. And that gives you a little bit of, like, leeway for tension, right? Somebody can have 2 warnings. Hey, I can't get another one. Or, okay, you have 3. If you fall behind one more time, you're toast. There's moments when boys stop and have to keep running. They have these little like Fitbit kind of things on their wrist that like keeps track of it for you. All that works good. I guess I had a little bit hope that maybe it was going to be more like a Prison Break kind of movie, or like they'd be like, you know, try to work out a way to get out of the situation. But for the most part, it's much more a meditation on the system and the problems with it and how we got to where we're at. And that's challenging emotionally for a movie that is just so grisly. Like it really doesn't shy away from the violence.
Yeah, like I said, it's a metaphor for war, for life itself. We see our cast get whittled down from a number of just bodily injuries because you're walking just until you can't. Just physical ailments. There's a lot about the psychology, and again, it's a parallel to war. But they all have different strategies about how they want to try and survive it. Some's like, well, I'm gonna, you know, expel more energy up front and actually like let myself get a warning or two and then recover. And there's a lot of talk about that and just different attitudes. It's interesting what we said. Why would anyone sign up for this? They talk about how everyone signs up for it. Everyone signs up for the lottery. They don't know anyone who has it because things are so bad that they would rather try and do this. And again, all of them, all but one will not make it. But they would rather that than whatever kind of meager existence they're eking out. So it's not about kind of overthrowing the system. There's talks about that, about like, I want to change things. And it's more about surviving the horrors as they come.
Yeah. I do want to talk really quickly about the setting before we wrap up. Although they shot it in Canada, it is just supposed to be like the Midwest. You don't get specifically where they're at. And it's nice seeing the country kind of in decline around these boys, because it really does get set up a good like kind of setting for this tale that they're telling of, yeah, a country in decline, right? And a country that's run by, you know, smog fueled factories and burned out cars and a military that is very indifferent towards like personal feeling and grief and strife, you know. That stuff all works pretty good, and it's a cheap shoot. Like, gosh, you can, you know, use a couple extras, have a blind cat sitting on a mailbox and like a long lonely shot pan by it. Like, it's good. Like, easy, simple filmmaking, like low budget, doesn't have to make a lot of money to make it back. solid. And oddly, I do think probably the most cynical of Stephen King's recent adaptations. He's had a hell of a last couple years at the movies. He's got like 4 or 5 adaptations out. I think he's got a TV show. I can't even remember. And this is one of the most latest ones after Life of Chuck, which Mark Hamill is also in, by the way, doing a big character. He's doing like drunk Wilford Brimley in that movie. And here he's like doing this big major character. Don't know how that worked out. But I think Long Walk is a cool because it's a special shape. But man, I struggled with it. So any other thoughts, Andy, for recommendations?
I think I'm ready.
Andy, would you recommend The Long Walk?
I would for those interested. It's definitely a serious movie, and it's a little heavy, and has, you know, it's dealing with heavy parallels to the Vietnam War and, you know, wars to come, a nation in decline. It's definitely not an uplifting kind of film, but there is something kind of beautiful about like the sentiment of what we do to survive the horrors and keep going. Kind of that's kind of its main message. It's not a must-see in theaters. I think if you're a little on the fence, probably save it for streaming.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat. Like, while I do think it is a cool shape for a movie, I think it's awful dour. I think it's got your potential to ruin your afternoon if you just throw this on and don't know what you're getting into. You know, you'll get to the end of it and be like, good God, like, that was miserable, you know? Like, it's rough. But a wonderful performance from David Johnson. Really great work from Cooper Hoffman. Like, not too shabby overall. It's cool. So if you're a cinephile, you like movies, you want to get out to something, go for it. But like, I don't think you should wander into this one without having an idea of what you're getting into, because I think you'll be miserable. You see this on Netflix on the front page and don't know any better, you're like, oh, I'll just throw this on. Like, you're gonna be like, what the hell is this? Like, it's unique, and I like that it's unique, but it just wasn't for me. It's just a little too rough, man. Like, I'm a big softy nowadays. Anyway, we got to talk about some upcoming trailers. All right, we got to get to some things that are coming out in the future. Excited to talk about it, Andy. What do we call this segment?
It's time for the trailer park. So we have a few trailers to bring you. We're going to start off with The Black Phone 2, which we did review the first film, The Black Phone 1, which was about the grabber, played by Ethan Hawke, a man who grabs children and is hiding them in his basement. And then one of these children, played by Mason Thames, eventually escapes from this situation because of a supernatural phone that's in the basement, where children who have been killed before kind of contact him from the afterlife and help him escape. That movie ends with the death of the grabber, but somehow he is back. Ethan Hawke with his creepy devil mask from beyond the grave. This movie is very much about the supernatural. He is struggling because of the PTSD of being a kidnapped child, and his sister begins dreaming of the grabber and receiving phone calls in her dreams. It's a little bit of Nightmare on Elm Street there, where things are happening in her dreams and then happening in real life. They end up on this icy lake. Looks really pretty creepy. Sounds a little derivative because the first one kind of wrapped everything up. But Zach, what do you think?
I did not really love Black Phone 1. I thought it was like a fine genre send up, but I didn't think much of it. And after it did well, I was really surprised wasn't that surprised to get a sequel. I have a hard time not laughing at The Grabber because it's just such a funny, stupid name for like a horror villain. And I love that he's back, because like, what else would you do in Black Phone 2, right? Like, Ethan Hawke was a big draw. He had the goofy mask. Sure, why not get Mason Thames back? Like, let's do it again. I don't know. It'll probably be a good time. I thought the first one was fine. I didn't think much of it. The Grabber. We gotta talk about the trailer for Wake Up Dead Man, a Knives Out mystery. So we finally got a trailer for this. Let me pull it up here. Boom. Josh O'Connor plays a young priest in a sleepy fall New England town. That's all I can tell. And with a big old church. When what appears to be the leader of his congregation, played by Josh Brolin, another priest, seems to be whacked or got or had, whatever happens in these Agatha Christie-esque mysteries. And Benoit Blanc, played by Daniel Craig, has to come out once more to help Josh O'Connor and his gang of local town stars and starlets figure out what's going on and who could have caused this horrible affliction on the local community. It's from Rian Johnson, writer-director of Knives Out and Glass Onion. If you are a fan of Knives Out and Glass Onion, cannot wait for this feature. Everybody I know that likes those movies says it's going to be awesome. It's got a big cast of characters in it. What do you think of the trailer for Wake Up Dead Man?
This looks like a lot of fun. These movies are always just star-studied, and they're really funny. Daniel Craig doing his Southern chicken fried accent, which is just
Foghorn,
really hilarious.
Leghorn.
But
I've heard
this has played at some of the festivals recently, and the number one thing I've heard is that Daniel Craig gets sidelined a little bit. Him and Josh O'Connor are kind of working together to solve the mystery of the murder, which is Josh Brolin. We've learned who plays Monsignor Jefferson Mix. And so they're working together, and Josh O'Connor takes over a large part of the movie, which is kind of surprising. A great cast, and I love the names of all these people. So we have Glenn Close, Mila Kunis, Kerry Washington, Kaylee Spaney, Thomas Hayden Church, Josh Brolin, Jeremy Renner, Andrew Scott, and more. And they all have such great names. You have Dr. Nat Sharp, the Reverend Jed Duplensity, Martha Delacroix, Vera Draven, Simone Vivant. Like, these are all it's like Agatha Christie style names. This looks like fun. It's getting a short theatrical release in the middle of November before being on Netflix on December 12th, I believe. It's a shame it won't get more of a theatrical release, but it looks great. It looks fun.
Yeah, go see it in theaters if you can. We're definitely going to catch it for the show and cover it here, so you know, keep an eye out on your local. Well, hold on. You have to keep an eye out for anything. Just subscribe to our script. We'll tell you all about it when it comes out. How about that? I promise you, I will let you know personally when Knives Out, Wake Up Dead Man is coming to a theater near you. What's next?
Christy. So this is a new boxing drama starring Sydney Sweeney. This is the second movie, one of two that we're going to be talking about in this segment, which we had talked about a little bit while ago. And this was, of course, going to be set up to be her Oscar run. She plays boxer Christy Martin, which was a successful female boxer in the 80s and 90s, who had lots of drama inside and outside the ring, which is usually how these dramas go. And Sydney Sweeney is transformed here. There's one of the big physical transformation. She put on about 20, 25, 30 pounds for the role. She doesn't really look great in this role.
Oh, come on.
Not because she's put on. Sorry, I don't mean because she's put on weight. I mean because she doesn't look like a fighter. She doesn't look like a boxer. Like her wigs all look kind of bad. I remember I saw this and I told Zach, I was like, this looks like the Walk Hard of boxing dramas. Like this looks like a parody of a boxing movie.
The shape of it's not great, and yeah, we were talking about it. Like it looks bad, especially next to like Smashing Machine coming out, because Smashing Machine looks so grounded, and Dwayne Johnson is huge. Or like, I'm gonna compare it to another male boxing movie, which is wrong, but like Iron Claw, right? That's wrestling, but like, God, we watch she just does not. She doesn't look like Sydney Sweeney, and she doesn't look like anybody particularly notable. So yeah, I don't know. She comes off looking a little goofy, but I'm hoping it's just this trailer and that it'll be a more emotional journey, right? Ben Foster's in it, like as this balding husband character. Seems like they've got a lot of conflict going on. But I'm with you. The first trailer looks fine.
So the high watermark of boxing dramas, particularly with women, is 2004's Million Dollar Baby with Hilary Swank, who won an Oscar for that role. That won Best Picture, Best Director, won a bunch of awards. And Hilary Swank did have an incredible transformation. Like, she is unbelievably ripped in that movie. She looks like a fighter. There's lots of boxing scenes. That movie is so much more about the boxing than this looks like. And some background on Christy Martin: she was a successful boxer, but there was also lots of domestic violence in her life. I think there was a plot to like a murder for hire plot that she was not involved in, she was nearly the victim of. So lots of off-screen stuff. Ben Foster's the most, he's the best looking part of this movie. Like, he's nearly unrecognizable as this also fat balding guy. He looks great. Sydney Sweeney just looks like she's wearing a bunch of costumes. It's just,
she goes through a bunch of costume changes. Yeah. You do see a couple different hairstyles and like, you know, I don't know. I'm with you. I don't think it looks great, but hey, you know what? I'll give another trailer. Who knows? Maybe it'll come out. I don't think she's taking bad roles. We need to talk about the other movie she's in. She is in a movie called The Housemaid, which I'm going to speak out of turn here. I don't know anything about. I know it's based on a book, and apparently that book sold like gangbusters, dog. So I think Lionsgate has a hit on their hands with The Housemaid. This is from director Paul Feig, who we saw most recently did Jackpot for Amazon. He also did a lot of the Melissa McCarthy movies that you know, The Heat, Spy. He did Bridesmaids way back in like 2013, 14, which is really solid. He did a lot of episodes. He did a few episodes of The Office and Parks and Rec. He did Ghostbusters 2016. I don't know why I'm giving you all the Paul Feig stuff. The point is, I don't like Paul Feig a lot. That's what I was going to say. Ultimately, I don't like a lot of his stuff. And he's doing this new movie with Sydney Sweeney and Amanda Seyfried called The Housemaid, where Sydney Sweeney plays a young woman who is maybe a little bit kind of taking on a role at Amanda Seyfried's very affluent, rich estate, where she's going to be playing the housemaid who's living there. She meets Seyfried's husband, played by, what is his name? Brandon Sklenar. Sklenar? Sklen...
That's that guy. Brandon. His talent agency is trying to get him to be the next Batman.
He's he's like Glenn Howerton. Or not Glenn Howerton. He's like a Glenn, Chad Powers. Anyway, who am I thinking of?
Looks like Eastwood's
Twisters.
Son.
Yeah, he does kind of look like that. Like Scott Eastwood. Yeah. Yeah, he looks great.
Glenn Powell.
Anyway, Powell's what I'm thinking of. Anyway, yeah, Amanda Seyfried and Brandon Sklenar are married. Young Sydney Sweeney comes in and she starts being the housemaid. Things get exciting. Apparently things get violent. I don't know much about the plot, but it looks like it's going to be a book to movie adaptation. It's going to make them a bunch of money. It's coming to theaters. When in December? Yeah, this December. And Andy, what do you think?
This looks like one of those movies that has a huge built-in fan base. I feel like the trailer kind of gives everything away a lot. There's a lot of other movies in here. Like part of this reminds me of Midsommar. Part of it reminds me of Hereditary, definitely in it. Again, I don't know the story either, but Reese Witherspoon has this whole grift kind of where she has a book club, and you know, she endorses
the book. Is that where this comes from? Is this the Witherspoon book club?
No, I don't think so. But it reminds me of that, where like Reese Witherspoon has a book club. She'll endorse a book. All her fans and followers then buy that book. The studio see how successful it is, and they're just like, okay, let's make a movie version of it. And so it's a little bit of that. There's a huge fan base built in because the book is so successful, and a December release date means that they think it's pretty good. That December is big movie going time around the holidays, so that'll be good for like wine moms, for lack of a better demographic. It looks fine. I'm sure it'll do well.
Yeah, so Sweeney's got two solid features coming out. One's a bit of a character joint. The other is like solid book adaptation where she's playing a character who looks much more like her traditional roles, right? Like got the long blonde hair out. Yeah, there you go. Sydney Sweeney, working hard. It's going to be great. And that's what's coming up. What are we talking about next? Oh, we're talking about a little bit of television, aren't we? Yeah. I forgot. I need to get some kind of music stinger or something for this. Do we have a formal name for this, Andy?
We're calling this the TV corner, for now, which we did. We started a couple of months ago and was really successful. There was a lot of interest in it, so we're gonna keep it going. And we're gonna be talking about episodes 3 through 6 of Alien Earth. We'll keep it as spoiler free as possible. Again, to recap, the first two episodes, the USCS Maginot ship crashes in Prodigy territory, which is the corporation. There's a bunch of aliens on board, including the famous Xenomorph and some other fun friends, maybe not so fun friends. These hybrids, which are robots with human consciousness, are sent into kind of part of the rescue effort. They capture all these aliens. They bring them back to Neverland. There's a lot of Peter Pan allegory. And we're going to start with episodes 3 and 4, which kind of slow down a little bit. We get our zoo. We have our main character, Wendy, played by Sydney Chandler, begins to kind of be able to maybe communicate with the aliens, which is a really fascinating thing that she might, and we have yet to see, if she will, in fact, learn to communicate with the alien xenomorph. And what does the alien xenomorph have to say? That's going to be really interesting. We start to run into real ethical questions with the hybrids themselves about, you know, what are we doing with them? What does it mean to be human? Again, very Blade Runner. They're starting to break down, some of them as well. Morrow, who's a great character, he was the security officer on the ship that crashed. is intent on getting these zoo creatures back. It's kind of his only thing left in life. So some really deep questions in kind of episodes 3 and 4. Zach, what do you think?
I really like where this show is headed. Namely, I really like the episodes directed by series showrunner Noah Hawley. He did the first episode and episode 5, which we're going to talk about here in a second. Really tremendous. I would imagine he's probably doing the season finale. I would probably doing the last one. The other ones are good, for sure. But like any television show, you can't have awesome action and CGI all the time. You got to have a lot of people talking in rooms. And I think Alien Earth makes a lot of smart avenues into having individual problems for many of these characters. Maybe one too many, to be honest, because by the time we get to like episode 6, you start to realize, man, we sure are spinning an awful lot of plates. Each one of these synthetic kids has something going on with them. Like, even the smaller ones have their own subplots, some of them larger than others. Wendy is starting to communicate with the xenomorphs, which is a little strange. And really, like, I want to know more about what's going on with Moro. Like, he has really emerged as a fascinating individual, as kind of this antagonist who, cyborg antagonist who wrecked with the ship and is now basically cleaning up on behalf of Weyland-Yutani, who we know in the later Alien movies goes on to be the big scary corporation. All of this, of course, is wrapped in incredible looking sets. Like, whether they're filming out on Thailand at this Neverland Island project thing where they're supposed to be in the show, or they're on these like spaceship sets where a lot of episode 5 happens. Like, I love the way this show looks. It's just such a good looking sci-fi show. And it uses science fiction as like a perfect avenue to give you like big visuals, whether that be CGI or like practical sets with old blinking lights and cigarette smoke and things like it look like they came right out of Ridley Scott's Alien. That was a lot to say. I like where it's headed so far.
Yeah, I enjoy the show too. I think there's a little bit too much going on. There's a few too many subplots. You have the zoo of aliens that they've captured. You have I keep wanting to say Sydney Wendy, played by Sydney Chandler, who is kind of the teacher's pet. She's the favorite hybrid, also the most capable. She's able to maybe communicate with them. You have the other hybrids that are not doing so well, like Nibs, who believes she's pregnant at one point and is deemed a threat to herself and to others. You have Morrow trying to get the stuff back. There's too many plot lines. I think they could shave one or two and get a little bit more focused. But the ideas are very heavy and very complex about what does it mean to be human? What does transhumanism look like as we begin to modify ourself? I myself have had like LASIK surgery, for example, but you know, there's way more that you can do to yourself. Getting into episodes 5 and 6, episode 5, directed by Noah Hawley, is a flashback of what happened on the USCS Maginot, because we start in the ship and then we flash forward in the first episode to basically the entire crew being killed and it crashing. So we get the backstory on what happened, which is a really fascinating episode. We see that a fire has kind of broken out of containment. Morro is woken up. He suspects sabotage, starts doing an investigation. Secrets are revealed. Everything goes wrong. Protocols aren't followed. It's a great episode. It's almost like an Alien movie in itself. My favorite of the series so far.
Yeah, 5 is tremendous and should probably be submitted for Emmys next year. Which we'll talk about in just a second. I do want to talk about the Emmys that just happened, but like, I think 5 is, like you said, its own contained Alien episode, and it's so smart to give us the framework of something we've already seen before, like the original Alien film, where you've got like kind of your space truckers traveling across the universe, and there's a thing on board, and we don't know where it is, and we don't know how it operates, but we know it's a problem. And it's weird because our characters actually do know that it's a xenomorph. And we, the audience, know it's a xenomorph. So Hawley is very clever to write in the idea of sabotage. Something, there's a saboteur on board. There is some mystery element here that we can't control, that we don't know how to deal with. And that creates just enough chaos to sow like seeds of dissent and treachery and treason among the crew. You've got a shaky stand-in captain who had a romantic relationship with somebody on board who is suffering grief from that, who is unable to make decisions. You have Morrow, who is this cold, calculating individual who we know as some sort of villain antagonist kind of force from our previous episodes, who is here saying, hey, I'm going to take command of this. I'm going to get us on track. Like in this episode, he is our he's our protagonist. Like, he is fundamentally the character we're following. So we see him almost in sort of a heroic role. And we get a lot more explanation to who he is, where he comes from, his background. And most importantly, like, how he ended up surviving the crash and is here now and what he's going to do next. Like, it's dark, it's messed up, and man, it looks so much like an old Alien movie. Like, great sets with, like, tons of blinking lights and little knobs and switches and chains and cigarette smoke and slime. Like, all the things that make Alien, like, a fun, grimy watch are alive and well in episode 5. If you were going to show somebody one episode of the show, 5 is maybe a contender for the one to show them, like, in a bottle with nothing else, just to kind of get them interested, because it's just so well put together. Great work by Holly.
Yeah, that episode could have been done in a really boring and predictable way. The fact that it's a whodunit keeps it very interesting. The fact that there's some other aliens on board, not just the xenomorph that come into play. There's some stomach churning stuff in it. I remember seeing a warning that was like, do not eat or drink while watching episode 5. which is some great hucksterism. Episode 6, just came out last week, develops a little bit further with our kind of legal battle between Weyland Yutani and Prodigy, and there's some legal back and forth between them. We, again, our hybrids continue to either kind of devolve or enhance themselves. I want to say Sydney. Wendy is one of these things where people are worried about them losing their humanity. And she's like, well, maybe that's what we're supposed to. Maybe we're supposed to transcend and not be, quote unquote, human anymore. There's a lot to wrap up in just the next 2 episodes. Like I said, a lot of plot lines. I'm interested to see where we'll go. Episode 7 comes out tonight. So we'll have to see.
It's funny because when they announced this show, I figured, well, season 1 will be its own bottle. It'll be its own thing. It'll be mostly closed-ended because they won't know if they're going to get another season of this or not. But, like, they're absolutely making more of this show. I would be stunned if they stopped making this thing. This thing is going to be nominated for Emmys. Like, it is a tremendous... Well, I take it back. Maybe it won't because it's real far off from Emmys next year. It's real far away. But it might get forgotten by then. But it is really cool, and it's really special, and I really like what it's doing, and I can't believe I get to say that about an Alien show, because the idea of an Alien television show fundamentally gets against the, like, what Alien is. It just seems so counterintuitive, but somehow they managed to put together something really well. I do think, if I have any criticisms, a couple too many plot lines. I'm with you. Like, let's trim it down a little bit in season 2, tighten it up, maybe focus a little bit more on some characters, but otherwise, really tremendous. Like, really fantastic. The Peter Pan theme is still working, like, which is crazy. I never would have thought that would have worked on paper. Like, yeah, it's kind of tremendous for a first season. I'm glad we can talk about it. I know we don't do a lot of TV on the show, but I don't know. It's been a weird couple weeks, and we just figured, hey, we should talk about this. Which reminds me, we got a couple other shows to talk about briefly. Do you any more thoughts on Alien Earth before we move on?
No, I'm ready to go on. Wanted to briefly talk about Peacemaker, which is the new show on from Warner Brothers and DC, starring John Cena. Season 2. We're 4 episodes in on that. Also a very fun show. This is already tying into Superman. Like, some of the characters are directly from the Superman movie, not just two months ago, which is really fun. But we find Peacemaker having discovered this alternate dimension where he's a hero, and his family is different from it is the way it is in the first season. Like, in the first season, he's got this really terrible dad who's, like, the leader of this white supremacist group and is really abusive. And in this world, his dad is very loving and tender, and he has this completely different relationship. And he keeps kind of spending more and more time in this alternate dimension. But we feel like something's not quite right. It's one of those things where it's a little too good to be true. And so it's going to all go wrong at some point. Meanwhile, the rest of the team is the 11th Street Kids, they're called. They're all working their way back in their own different ways. Hardcore's trying to get back into intelligence work. Adebayo is developing her spy company. Not real successful up front, but the show's really fun. Tim Meadows is on it with a lot of, he's an incredible addition, a lot of great one-liners. I was listening on the podcast where they have a hard time just keeping a straight face because he's so funny. So that show's a lot of fun as well. We're halfway through, 4 episodes left. Superman comes out this Friday on digital, and apparently it might tie into the Peacemaker show. Some more yet to be seen, but that's been pretty exciting. Are you watching much any Peacemaker, Zach?
Yeah, I got a few episodes in for sure. I don't know if I caught the most recent one. Like, I'm terrible about keeping up with these things, but it's kind of tremendous. I'm really surprised the episodes aren't directed by James Gunn. They're written by him, but I think he's producing, so it's still got kind of the same energy and vibe. It doesn't get too far off from where we're at, but like otherwise guest directors. It's a lot of fun, man. And I like the idea of a superhero show playing with interdimensionality over the course of a season. Like, typically that's just a film. Typically we got like a 90-minute movie where Doctor Strange is in a different dimension and has to get back, or Ant-Man gets shrunk down to a different dimension and has to get back, or Fantastic Four, where it's all happening in a different dimension and none of it matters. Like, it's nice to have a hero or an anti-hero in the case of Peacemaker, who is like struggling to see that distinction, and that line is blurred, and he goes over to this other dimension, like everything is better. Everything is better in the other dimension. Like, everything is better for him. Oh my God, it is so much better. Like, life is so much better and sweeter. And it's like in at home in your actual life that you've worked at, you're depressed and everything sucks. And you go over there and it's like life is awesome. It seems there might be more to it, but really funny, really interesting. John Cena's amazing. Love the new intro. It's really growing on me. Peacemaker rocks.
Yeah, he's great, and he's grown as an actor from that first and second season. Really doing some tremendous stuff. Wanted to briefly talk about Gen V, which is the spinoff to The Boys, which is another superhero show, very subversive one on Amazon Prime. Season 2 starts tomorrow, actually. I didn't realize this was starting so soon. This deals with like these superheroes in college. It's like a college, it's a university for superheroes, and there's a lot going on. Sinisterly, it's a very gory and violent show. I really enjoyed season 1. We lost one of the cast members tragically to a motorcycle accident. So they either recast him or wrote him out of the show, something like that. But season 2 starts tomorrow if you're interested in that. Let's talk about these Emmys. Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I haven't caught up with Gen V. I really should. Honestly, I think I kind of fell off of The Boys. Not for lack of trying. It's just a lot of good stuff out there. And then you get behind and suddenly 3 episodes back and it's a whole thing. Anyway, we talk about the Emmys. Not much talk about the Emmys, to be honest. We're going to keep it tight. Typically, we'll go through and do like a list of the winners and losers. I don't think we really need to do that this year. I just want to talk about some of the highlights, namely this awesome like charity ticker that totally tanked. That thing was really funny, and I'm looking forward to getting into it. Yes, 2025 Emmys this year were hosted by Nate Bargatze, who is a stand-up comedian. And mostly the winners include HBO's The Pitt, the hospital drama starring Noah Weil, Apple TV Plus's The Studio, Seth Rogen show that we actually talked about a little bit on this show, and also Apple's Severance, which I am a big fan of and got some big awards. Those are most of the winners, like the big heavy hitters, your best actors and actresses, your best directors and showrunners. We don't need to worry too much about that. But what I did want to talk about is, you know, just kind of the highlights, which include, you know, Stephen Colbert riffing on getting canceled over on CBS and then winning an award and getting to get out and talk about it. He made a joke about it if anybody was hiring him. Got a big applause when he came out. That was a hit. Big viral. Not too shabby for old Colbert. Let's see what else. Severance. Tremble Tillman makes history as the first black man to win Best Supporting Actor in a Drama Series category. A little specific, but hey, I love Tremble Tillman, and he's so great as Seth Milchick on Severance. If you watch Severance, I think you know, and if you don't, you should. And any thoughts so far?
Well, yeah, we're missing out on Adolescence, which won Best Limited or Anthology Series, and also won awards for Stephen Graham, who was the lead actor and writer, and also the young, I gotta find his name, youngest winner ever, Owen Cooper, he plays the young boy in Adolescence, 15. And they filmed the show when he was 12, so like an incredible thing. Erin Doherty also won for supporting actress. It was amazing because he was like, 3 years ago I was nothing. He was like, 3 years ago you were 12.
Yeah. You were a child.
Like, yeah. Calm down. But yeah, Adolescence, a big winner. The Pit, not The Pit, The Studio also walked away. Apple, that Seth Rogen won for Best Actor, and the show. We're going to get a lot more. Hollywood loves it. Shows about themselves, movies about themselves. Not a big surprise. I guess the big upset is The Pitt winning Outstanding Drama, which a lot of people are upset about.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I haven't watched The Pit, but it seems like it's like, isn't they do like a 24 thing. It's like 15 episodes and each episode is an hour in one 15 hour
real
shift.
Time, yeah.
Yeah. Like that seems exciting. I don't know. Yeah. I hear Noah Wyle's been doing it since ER, man. Like he's probably really great. So I love Adam Scott for Severance. I really do, but I think he'll get it. Give him time. Additionally, we had a lot of folks advocating for Gaza, which was really cool. Hannah Einbinder from Hacks did a thing for her speech and wore an artist for Ceasefire pin. Javier Bardem wore, how do you say this? Kefaya? I don't know. He was out on the red carpet talking about Gaza. Like, that stuff all rocks. Love people turning out, talking about what's important to them. And, let's see. Cosby Show star Felicia Rashad remembered Malcolm Jamal Warner. He was lost earlier this year. He remains in our hearts, which is very sweet. And this is a video and a music performance. And, the ticking clock. We gotta talk about this thing. Did you see this, Andy? This is yeah, I didn't know this thing timed out, which is really funny. So in order to keep speeches short, the idea was, right, in order to keep people from talking over their allotted time during acceptance speeches, Nate Bargatze had an idea. He said, I'm gonna put up a ticker on screen and we're gonna put $100,000 on it to the Boys and Girls Club of America. And whenever a winner goes over their allotted time, for every second, we're pulling $1,000 off. $1,000 off their alleged 45 seconds, a lot of 45 seconds, right? Which can add up quickly for some of these stars out here. But every time they were less than 45 seconds, they'd add $1,000 for every second to keep people tight, right? That was the idea. So pretty much over the course of the evening, what this means is every time somebody went over 45 seconds, a ticker would show up with like two hands holding each other and a number, and it would just start running down. And it was like, here's all the money you're not giving to charity because you're selfish and talking too long. And it was kind of amazing. It was hilarious and really funny, and I really liked it. And hilariously, it dipped below $0. It ran out. And they made it right. CBS said they're going to contribute like $100,000, and he's going to kick in a bunch. So it worked out. They made a total donation of like $350,000 or something. It's great. Shout out to the Boys and Girls Clubs of America. I love that it ran to zero. That's like the funniest possible outcome, is that they ran the thing all the way down. It's hilarious.
Yeah, that's not a great look. I remember seeing that and I was like, what is that thing counting down to?
Really funny.
Yeah, it seems really counterintuitive. You would want to do, I guess, the opposite. As a joke almost, where like the longer you go, it actually gets more money just because that would be more charitable. Wanted to talk also that Kristen Milioti won for The Penguin, which was another show that we really enjoyed. And Colin Farrell did not win because he lost to 15-year-old Owen Cooper. And I do feel bad for Colin Farrell because so much of that show is like he was in the makeup chair at 5 a.m. and he'd be in the makeup for 12 hours. And it was like an exhausting thing.
Yeah. Penguin suit, dude. Yeah.
For 8 or 9 episodes. And then, he didn't win. And then, but great for Kristen Milioti, 'cause she's great in The Penguin.
Yeah, dude. Overall solid. Listen, I would love it if my favorite shows took home every award, but that's never how it goes. Like, solid Emmys. Way to go. Please bring back the charity ticker and also make it more extreme and more damning somehow. Like, ramp it up. I don't know. Maybe you go go the opposite way. Have it donate money to a cause that's absolutely abhorrent and horrible. How about that? And that way people will be like, well, I can't actively contribute to this thing that sucks. Like, rather than take away from the potential of something good, you contribute direct to something bad, right? That's the answer. You know, cigarettes for, organization for cigarettes for children or something. Anyway, we got to wrap up the show. That's it. That's episode 307 of Off Script. My God, next week we're coming back with two movies, I promise. Andy, what are we watching?
We're going to be watching Him, which is the Jordan Peele produced, not directed, horror film starring Marlon Wayans. I think it's Marlon Wayans.
Yeah.
About a young college quarterback who wants it all, who wants to be the best there ever was, the GOAT, and is willing to sacrifice everything. And this sounds like a very cliche, but something sinister is going on. The trailer's got a lot of blood in it. There's bad things going on behind the scenes. It looks really interesting. And we don't really get sports horror movies. We get, you know, sports action, sports dramedy, sports comedy. Sports horror isn't something we usually get, but this looks really interesting and really creepy. So we're looking forward to that. And we're going to be TBA, our second thing. Some other things that are out. Big, Bold, Beautiful Journey, which is the new Koganada film starring Colin Farrell, who we just talked about. And the great Margot Robbie, her first film since Barbie, actually. We don't really know much about this film. It looks kind of strange, a little bit of that Walter Mitty feel, but that's out this weekend. Also, some new to streaming. Superman will be out this Friday, September 19th, which is only 2 months since its release date, which is kind of crazy, but apparently it ties into the Peacemaker show in some way, and that's why they wanted it out. A not-so-kept big, well-kept secret is I think Superman is showing up in the show. That's why they wanted you to see it. Also, Nudja 2 is going to be out on PVOD with the English dub if you're interested in watching that as well. So if, him and TBA for next week.
Yes. If you enjoyed the show today, I feel like we're doing it off script. If you want to check out our review of him next week or TBA, we'll see. We got some irons in the fire. We got some cooking over here. Best way to do that is keep up with us by just subscribing to the show. Subscribe on your favorite platform, podcast platform. If you're an audio listener, you like to take us on the go, or if you like watching on video, we don't live stream the show, but we upload to YouTube. You can check us out over there on our YouTube channel, Off Script Film Review. Clips, full reviews. We got all kinds of stuff going on over there. So come slide on over. Check out the YouTube channel. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, we're in all the usual places. If you listen on audio, Spotify, Google Play, iTunes, iHeartMedia, you can find us over there as well. Leave a rating and review while you're at it. On those audio platforms, helps us out a bunch. Way more than you know, I promise. It might seem insignificant to you, I promise. And the almighty algo makes a really big difference, I swear. You can check out our website, offscriptfilmreview.com. You can email us correspondence directly from you to us. From your lips to I was going to say your lips to God's ears, but that's not us. We're just podcasters. From you to us, mail at offscriptfilmreview.com. From all of us at Offscript, the home of Bold Cinema, I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.